Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So, if you like learning about aerospace power, you're in the right place. To our regular listeners, welcome back, and if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. For a long time, we have focused a lot of our discussions on the threat posed by China. And for good reason. Let's face it, their goals are often opposed to ours, they've got the means to press us, and they've demonstrated a willingness to act. Gone are the days of unilateral U.S. superiority. But guess what? The challenges we face aren't limited to the Pacific. Russia continues to press aggressively, and it's something we need to take seriously. Remember, these folks don't just talk a tough game, they often act. Remember the interventions we saw in Georgia and Ukraine, intervention in Syria, plus other forms of hostility, much of it being online. And with each of these acts of aggression, there wasn't a lot of warning. Russian forces charged ahead fast, and they used the Allies' slow deliberation as a window to cement their gains. Bottom line, they acted, and we just talked. They even shot down a 777 airliner and faced very few repercussions past some diplomatic pressures. So, we need to think a lot more carefully about Russia. What are their goals? What is our best guess as to how they're going to manifest these objectives? When are lines crossed that affect our interests? And how can we best respond to check hostile actions and not just wring our hands?
Okay, so with us today to discuss this topic is Justin Bronk, and he is visiting us today from the UK, where he serves as a research fellow for air power and technology at Royal United Services Institute, known to most of us as RUSI, a defense-focused think tank based in London. Justin's also an air power expert, and he's deeply familiar with the challenges that I just outlined.
Hey, Slick, thanks for having me.
Well, I really appreciate having you here, and also bringing along Sam Craney-Evans, who is a C4ISR analyst at RUSI as well.
Hi, Slick. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you as well. And we also have Heather Penny with us from Mitchell. So Heather, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Slick. Good to be here.
All right. So Justin, we'll get started with you. And if you can, just paint the picture for us regarding the European landscape and how Russia fits into the equation.
So the European security landscape is kind of divided from north to south. And what you find is that countries in the southern part of Europe within the NATO alliance, so think Italy, particularly Spain, Greece, are much more concerned with kind of migrant security flows, instability in the Middle East, and the northern part of Europe, so particularly France, Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, and the Baltic states, and going up in Scandinavia in the UK, are very much focused on Russia as their primary security threat, particularly since obviously the annexation of Crimea in 2014. And there's been a kind of continued drumbeat of Russian aggression since then, both in terms of things like special forces operations in allied but non-aligned countries like Sweden, where you've seen active sabotage operations. There have been, of course, the chemical warfare attack with a weapons-grade nerve agent on UK soil, which killed a UK citizen, conducted by the Russians. And so, along with kind of the more traditional airspace probing, interfering in elections, funding far-right and far-left parties, kind of general destabilization operations, and with a significant build-up being discussed around Russian military presence around the borders of Ukraine at the moment, there is once again, a significant fear that there's going to be a major escalation to conflict in Ukraine. And, whether that spills over into conflict with the alliance is, again, something that a lot of countries in Europe are really worried about.
Yeah, Justin, I really appreciate that. I mean, just listening to you put all those pieces together makes you realize, that there is a lot happening in a very systemic way from Russia around Europe. And you guys are right at the forefront of it. So I appreciate that description. And Heather, I want to ask you this, because I know at Mitchell, we've, looked at this challenge for a long time. We spent a lot of time, and I know that you've spent a lot of your time in your career thinking about the Soviet Union. But what's changed in the Cold War today? I mean, for us to properly respond to a threat, we need to understand the variables and motivations in play. And I bet they've changed a lot since the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, no doubt. I think when people today in America talk about a Cold War, they're referring to China and they neglect Russia. I mean, after all, we won that Cold War, right? And so after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, we just think of Russia as a bit player. They've got a weak economy, they lack real international influence, and they've got a defanged military. So we're not really thinking about Russia as part of this Cold War. And while Russia certainly does have its challenges and it's not a 10-foot-tall bear, they've already demonstrated their ability and their willingness to pursue their strategic objectives, like Justin just talked about. I don't think these strategic objectives will surprise anyone. To reestablish their control and influence over the Soviet territories and client states, to regain their global stature as a strategic power, and to reshape the norms and dynamics that govern the world order in ways that benefit Russia. And they are already doing this. I think what's unique is how fast Putin is doing this. So this is really not the static Cold War of the Soviet Union. This is a fast-changing ballgame. And Putin's very clever in how he's pursuing these goals.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Putin there. And I want to ask Justin directly to drill down a little bit more and, you know, let's play a little game here. If we had the ability to meet with Putin and his top leaders, what do you think we'd hear from them most? And what do you think their main objectives are? And how does that relate to how they engage in the diplomatic community?
So I'd say Russia's kind of key objectives at the head of state leadership level, although a lot of Russians who are familiar with it would kind of refer to the collective Putin, the sort of leadership strata in which Putin is kind of the first among equals. But you know, he very much rules by permission from that kind of kleptocratic layer at the top of the Kremlin. They kind of have a few key goals. One of them, exactly as Heather said, is to reestablish a dominant say in the affairs of the nations immediately around their borders that they kind of still think of as kind of Russia's near abroad, its backyard, you know, former client states as part of the Soviet Union. And, you know, in order to do that, they really have to demonstrate that Article 5, the kind of cornerstone of NATO collective defense, is a bluff. Because until collective defense is kind of discredited from the Russian perspective, they have to deal with even very small neighbors that they feel they instinctively should have a kind of, you know, defining say over their kind of major political decisions. So the Baltic states are obvious examples. Instead, they kind of have to deal with this relatively monolithic bloc in NATO, which is dramatically more powerful, more wealthier, and kind of more desirable place to live, has a lot more soft power than Russia. If they can demonstrate through kind of limited military action with a sort of overwhelming concentration of force in a limited area that the alliance doesn't have the stomach to actually, you know, go and fight the Russians over, say, a sliver of Estonia or something, if they can do that, then suddenly collective deterrence kind of evaporates. And once again, all of those kind of neighboring states have to go back to dealing with Russia as the big neighbor on a bilateral basis. And suddenly they have a kind of controlling say again. So a lot of the military concerns are around the fear that the Russians will do something that is large enough and bold enough to demonstrate that there should be a response under Article 5, that it's a clear Article 5 violation of kind of alliance member territory, but is too small to kind of justify to the main publics of the kind of major NATO powers, the US most obviously, but also France, the UK, to kind of justify to their publics that a military response is required. So that's where a lot of the fear is. And of course, you know, number one priority in any kleptocratic dictatorship is they want to stay in power. They worry about particularly color revolutions as they see it. So they see, for example, the revolution in Ukraine, the Maidan, as, you know, Western CIA kind of inspired and controlled. Not the case, but they think it is. And so they're very worried about the kind of perception among their own people that, you know, Western-style democracy, freedom, alignment is preferable, and that, you know, the regime is seen as kind of losing its control or anything. So a lot of the external messaging that we worry about, one should remember, it's primarily directed at their own people, because the biggest thing they fear is losing control as a regime.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, and I appreciate that. And I'd like you to look through the lens of the recent Russian aggression and some of the things that you talked about. How do these motivations explain what we saw in Georgia, Ukraine, Syria, on the internet and beyond?
So worth remembering, of course, Georgia, Ukraine, major Russian aggression in Europe, you know, armed invasions of other European sovereign nations, but neither of them are NATO members. They were NATO partners, but that's a very different thing. They're not covered by Article 5. And what you see there is Russia basically fighting limited, sustained, high-intensity conflicts in short bursts in order to destabilize a significant enough chunk of both Georgia and Ukraine to basically get a controlling say over the decision-making process in each nation's capital. So, for example, in Ukraine, you have Donbass that is kind of occupied, forms this kind of festering sore, this frozen conflict in Ukraine that means that the government in Kiev basically is at kind of the mercy of Russia's ability to escalate or cause problems at any given moment, and kind of has this very expensive, very, very damaging, grueling kind of frozen conflict on its soil. And that means that it can't, for example, pursue greater integration with the EU. It can't pursue potentially NATO membership, because NATO requires that you don't have a conflict with a major power before you can accede. So that's blocked off in both cases. And I think fundamentally, when you look at Syria, for example, as well, it also shows that Russia's strategy in military intervention terms is primarily opportunistic. They saw opportunities to advance their geopolitical position at relatively low cost and low risk. And so they took them. In most cases, there doesn't seem to have been a huge amount of pre-planning. It doesn't seem to have been a kind of a major strategy thought over a couple of years. It was a case of, well, actually, we can probably do this. Let's move the forces into place. Forces in place. Do we think there's going to be a response? Actually, probably not from the West in general. So let's just do it, see how it goes. It tends to be quite calculated. And when you do see Russia meet serious resistance, the Turks shooting down a fencer over their airspace on the border with Syria, for example, what you actually seem to see is the Russians pulling back. A lot of that angry rhetoric comes out, but they don't actually keep pushing. If they encounter a real red line, they kind of, you know, the message seems to be, right, actually, okay, you mean that red line. Cool, we'll find another place to push.
Tremendously interesting. And I want to switch over to Heather, because we have a new national defense strategy under development. And how should we look at Justin's observations and impact for this effort? I mean, it sounds like we're talking about China all the time when we hear from our defense leaders, but I'm guessing there are important nuances that we need to highlight here.
Well, you know, Slick, I don't know that it's really a nuance that we're talking about here. And if you go back to what Justin said regarding Russia being an opportunistic actor, I think that clearly means that the new national defense strategy needs to consider two simultaneous conflicts going on at the same time. Because if we are engaged anywhere, for example, if something comes up in the South China Sea and we require, or even another minor regional conflict, you're going to see Russia take advantage of that. And so I think that that's really a key element there, is that we need to think differently about how we stage what this new national defense strategy is going to say. We need to move beyond a single conflict, be prepared for two simultaneous and major conflicts, and that's going to drive a very different posture. We know that there's a new posture under review. That probably means that we need to forward base back into Europe to be able to provide that kind of deterrent strategy and rapid response to be able to keep NATO strong at the same time that we're having to deal with China and their actions with Taiwan, as well as continuing to provide that kind of security and stability type operations around the globe that we've been doing for decades. So it's a much more complex environment than we've seen in the past. And the other thing we need to do is be able to deal with more gray zone type operations, because we've seen Russia exploit this. We're seeing China exploit this as well. And we don't have a strategy for how we deal with operations beneath those trigger points.
Well, and Heather, just to quickly pile on there, what's your take on how the Hill and the broader policy community thinks about Russia today?
Well, you know, again, I think there's a fundamental neglect of Russia, not only as a major power, but again, as this opportunistic spoiler. So for many in the national security and defense community, I think we're treating Russia too much like an afterthought. You know, Russia's excelling in information operations, propaganda, again, like I said, operating in the gray zone in ways that shy away from what could trigger a conventional response from us. And they do this knowing that we lack that kind of strategy or capability to check them within this gray zone, and importantly, check how they're operating information and propaganda and so forth here in the United States. So I think Russia's betting that we will be deterred by the threat of a hot war. I mean, just think about how we didn't respond to Georgia, how we didn't respond to the Ukraine. And look at all the rhetoric right now surrounding Poland and Belarus. I mean, it's all talk, but right now, not a whole lot of bite from the United States. So it's shocking to me that these past hostile actions have largely gotten neglected in today's security debate and really not getting a whole lot of attention on the Hill either. I think this actually increases the risk calculus for us because we're going to be more likely to be surprised. We're going to be scrambling for options, and we're not going to have not just simply the technologies and the operational concepts and the capabilities, but we'll fail to engage in that narrow window of opportunity. So it's another fait accompli, if you will, that we won't be able to check.
Sure. Well, and I want to get Sam in on the conversation as well. And, you know, you've been listening for a little bit, Sam. So what do you think about, you know, Heather's comments so far, and what is it like in the UK and in the rest of Europe? And, you know, does having Russia in your backyard serve as a focusing factor?
Yeah, it definitely does serve as a focusing factor. I think from my perspective, one of the things that is really useful to focus on is the way that Russia has actually modernized since 2008. So for me, one of the challenging things is that the gray zone operations and this concept of hybrid war is actually quite distracting. I think it is a problem, and it creates an atmosphere of constant competition that we're not really used to in the West. It's quite confrontational. But at the end of the day, Russia's modernization since 2008 has been of its conventional military. And I think kind of drawing on what Heather mentioned there towards the end is that, you know, there have been strong words over Poland and Belarus and even Ukraine. But the question is that the Russian military has actually modernized extensively. And deterrence, you can't deter Russia by countering its gray zone operations. It has to be deterred militarily because, as Justin said, it's an opportunistic power. So if it suddenly finds for some magic reason that it can't influence us through social media, it will look for other avenues because it sees influencing our populations as a valuable tool. And so I think we need to balance this hybrid, this gray zone, you know, however you want to phrase it and define it, very carefully with actually a very, very strong, very capable conventional deterrence. And I think to some extent, you know, that applies to China as well as it does to Russia, because they both have their own theories of competition. You know, China certainly we can see very interested in economic power and building its ability to draw people into its influence through its economics. But at the end of the day, also a large conventional military modernization that is designed to alter this multipolar situation throughout the world. Russia definitely shapes the way we're thinking in the UK, but you can see from the fact that we have sent, you know, our pride and joy notionally off to the Asia Pacific region, the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier, that we also think sure. about China. And in the UK, there is kind of a debate about how do we balance these two threats, these two disparate opponents.
If I could just come back on a couple of things there and build on what Sam said.
Please do.
It's worth remembering, of course, that Russia has not only extensively modernized its conventional forces, but it's also completed modernization of its nuclear triad in a way that the US has been consistently failing to do, and the UK, because we've been balking at the kind of extraordinary cost bow wave. You know, in the UK, we only have the submarine launched part of the triad, but you know, Russia has completed that modernization, and it's now just, you know, finishing rolling out, you know, new land-based ICBMs, heavyweight liquid-fueled ICBMs, road mobile and rail mobile testing, new generation of boomers, new generation of penetration aids, hypersonic glide vehicles for those RVs. And, you know, that perception that Heather mentioned, that kind of Russia is this sort of defeated power, it's worth remembering that it's not only the only power on Earth that can match the US in the nuclear arena. It actually significantly surpasses the US's capabilities in the nuclear arena, not only at the sort of high-end strategic exchange kind of level of things, but it also has far more gradated levels of what they might term tactical or battlefield nuclear capabilities and credible means of delivering them. They're not just dependent on free-fall bombs anymore. So, you know, Russia doctrinally, you know, has quite early low nuclear thresholds. It's one of their key kind of doctrinal ways of dealing with the fact that they lose any long war scenario with NATO, basically because they have the first mover advantage and they're planning to fight, you know, relatively close to their own borders with a lot of very heavy armor. They can overmatch any forces that we can put in place on the ground for the first kind of month or so of any conflict until the US and others manage to mobilize heavy forces and push them through. For example, the UK at the moment would take a minimum of a month to generate anything close to you know, the majority of an armored division. And in fact, we couldn't at the moment do that and get it out there to Eastern Europe. So the Russians can kind of win the first couple of weeks and keep, hopefully, as far as they're concerned, keep air at bay with this very dense integrated air defense system. Again, the most capable in the world, more capable than the Americans or the Chinese. And so then, as kind of NATO traditionally, doctrinally, would be building this sort of steel mountain in Eastern Europe to then go and take back what's lost, the Russians can credibly threaten to go straight up the nuclear escalation ladder, starting quite low where we don't have symmetrical responses with the threat of World War III and the end of the world at the higher end. So their hope is that they can kind of win an initial war and then make it so risky and costly to take it back that NATO's greater strength won't politically be capable of being brought to bear. So it's not just that conventional modernization, but the nuclear matters too.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you, Heather, I'm having flashbacks to being a lieutenant in intel briefings going, oh my gosh, you know, you just hear this threat and it's impossible. And then you turn around and, you know, get some academics on how we'll defeat this threat. So I want to start to think about the other side here and hear from Justin and Sam on what are key trends that you all are watching when it comes to European allies and how they intend to manage this Russian threat that's right there in the backyard.
So there's a lot of very, very worried head scratching going on and a lot of trying to cast things politically as, we're going to go and fight them in constant competition in these sort of hybrid gray zone conditions, because quite frankly, that's a lot easier and cheaper and much fluffier and kind of more difficult to define. Because if you look at Russia as a conventional nuclear force problem, the bill for that starts to look very, very expensive very quickly, particularly for European powers. There are some European countries that do kind of have a credible force design and force posture that is focused on Russia. So one of them, of course, being the Danes, who have always done an armored battle group. That's their output. They never changed that during the War on Terror. They do an armored battle group, and then they plan to plug it into a division. The Finns, not in NATO, but are in the EU and a close ally. Their entire force posture is around accepting they can't stop the Russians pushing in across their border, but that they will bleed the Russians dry before they actually achieve their objectives. And they can look you in the eye. I was there the other week. They can look you in the eye and credibly say, we will break the Russians if they invade us. And they mean it. And the Russians respect it, which is quite interesting. But again, they have 280,000 people that they can mobilize in 10 days. So, you know, far above what most European countries can do and what the US could quickly put into theater. If you look at something like the UK, you know, we're looking at how to remodernize the armed forces, particularly for the Air Force and the Army, how we kind of look at the Russia problem. The issue is that while the Air Force has most of the component parts, we don't have a lot of those key enablers that we rely on the Americans for, particularly dynamic targeting in a missile engagement zone, of which there are many in Eastern Europe. And there's also a reliance very much on kind of intelligence processing and you know, target packaging creation and things like that. We don't really have enough personnel to do that on our own. And in terms of munitions, for example, stocks of standoff munitions just aren't really where they need to be. For the army, it's much harder because anything that's heavy enough to survive and fight against the Russians on the ground, where you know they have more artillery than God and just about as many tanks, will be too heavy, even if we could afford it, to deploy quickly out to Eastern Europe. And anything that's light enough to self-deploy is too light to fight and survive there when it gets there. So, we're having serious problems trying to work it out. And the current mood music is now to start rebasing British capabilities in Germany so that they're close enough to help. But, you know, small steps. At the moment, it's a big concern.
The way I kind of look at it is with Russia and China, there are actually opportunities, right? There are, kind of as you said, Heather, they're the 10-foot tall bear at the moment, at least. And their claws are massive and their jaws are massive. And there's no way to get close to them. But if you look at them, there are similar weaknesses as there are in a NATO force, right? They're reliant on command and control networks between their artillery fire control systems and their artillery groups in exactly the same way that a NATO force is. So that is a weakness that can be focused in on and it can be unpicked. Their electronic warfare capabilities are comprehensive and they are designed to cover the entire electromagnetic spectrum for a reason, because they want to disorganize and disaggregate our command and control. But also, unlike a lot of advanced Western electronic warfare systems, you know, they're very siloed. So you have one system that can kind of deal with satellites and a few other things, but it can't deal with anything outside of that bandwidth. Whereas in, you know, the US is working on systems that you will have one vehicle that can deal with most of the spectrum and can be very capable in that. So if you look at things like this, where they are reliant on all of these different vehicles, as soon as you start unpicking it, and you know, you pick one system and you engage and destroy it, that system is no longer there to deliver the effects that they rely on to fight their type of war. And I think there are opportunities in the way that our adversaries notionally would choose to fight. And I think we need to talk about them as much as we talk about the risks that their way of war actually poses to us.
You know, Sam, I really like how you phrase that regarding really it, for us in the U.S., this means that we would start to rebalance away from just looking at capabilities and capability gap analysis in order to determine what we acquire and what we need to have within our force structure, but really move back more towards a threat analysis to begin to look at how do we begin to counter the Russian way of war and the Chinese way of war and the unique capabilities that they have that are not necessarily shared, because this may mean that we need to develop some specialized niche capabilities in the European theater and other specialized niche capabilities in the Pacific theater. There may be some crossover, but not necessarily. And importantly, it may also drive different operational concepts in both of those theaters so that we're hitting the weak points of Russia, of China, in order to be able to resolve any conflict successfully and on our terms. And I think that also means that we need to spend more time understanding the unique theories of victory for both Russia and China, how that drives their operational concepts, because although there are similarities, we cannot simply just take, you know, there's so much focus right now in the U.S. on China, China, China. You can't just pick that up and then apply that to Russia and think that we're going to be successful. So I really like how you're differentiating Russia from China and their EW capabilities and how they're going to focus that electronic warfare against our command and control systems.
I can add to that as well. I think it's super important that we really strive to understand the Russian perspective and the Chinese perspective. We don't have to agree with it, but we need to think about how the people making the decisions and going through their military thought in Beijing sit at home and they see the world around them, because that, I think, ideally we'd probably choose to avoid war with China and Russia if that's at all possible. That would be great. And we can only really do that if we understand how they see the world, because then you can open up channels of conversation with them. But also from a military perspective, there used to be a phrase during the Cold War of NATO preferred Russian tactics, right? NATO would really prefer it if Russia did this, you know, and you kind of say to people, that's not what they're going to do, because they know that you would like them to do it. So I think there also has to be an emphasis on, you know, we need to understand them at the geopolitical level, but we need to understand militarily what they will be looking to do, because they've spent years, as long as I've been alive, studying the US military, both of them, and they've arrived at different conclusions. But I think it's time that we put that work in and we study the Chinese and the Russian militaries and we understand them equally.
Certainly also very interesting to note that, as you say, they've come to significantly different conclusions. And one of the outputs that one sees on that is that the PLAAF and the PLAN in particular, you know, yes, we can look at certain differences, but they appear to be trying to build something that looks remarkably like, in most respects, the US Air Force and the US Navy. And that really isn't what you see with the Russians. You know, the Russians have a very, very specific concept of war that is based on the fact that they plan to fight very close to their own borders. You know, this is not the Soviet Union. The plan is not to drive to, you know, the French coast in however many weeks behind a kind of over a sort of nuclear wasteland where the front line once was. But they do plan to have the ability to concentrate overwhelming force and then limit a conflict in their near abroad. And so, for example, you see a much greater emphasis on heavy tracked vehicles, heavy tracked firepower on the ground, because if you only want to go about, you know, 50 to 150 kilometers from your own lines, that makes perfect sense. Your logistics can be push logistics, as the Russians are. They don't have to be, you know, pull logistics to support a significant expeditionary effort. And they can really rely on organic ground-based firepower to reduce their dependency on what we would probably term joint force effects or joint all domain operations concepts, as we see kind of being pursued in ever greater vigor on both sides of the Atlantic. Because quite frankly, as you said, Sam, the Russians plan to kind of basically deny large parts of the spectrum in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum most of the time. And they understand that in doing so, they will frag their own communications as well as ours. So the ability to have ground-based formations which have most of their own required enablers within the formation and can actually proceed according to a relatively inflexible, but actually pretty, you know, non-comms dependent set of 12-hour orders instructions, including everything from air defense to bridging to kind of chemical troops to provide concealment and that kind of thing. Yeah, it's a very specific way of fighting that's around their specific requirements. The final thing I'd just add on kind of getting in their heads in terms of a common deterrence framework would be to observe that no nation in history has ever started a war that they anticipate to be a long and difficult one. So, you know, if you're looking at how to try and deter that deterrence, of course, has to be in the minds of your opponents. It's no good convincing yourself how wonderfully relevant to deterrence your latest capabilities are. We in the UK are very, very guilty of that. Saying, for example, tanks were relevant to deterrence. Well, they're not, because the Russians look at tanks, and deterrence in Europe requires the Russians to be deterred, not us. But then look at, you know, what are their contingencies around how they could have a short, sharp, clean victory in limited conditions, and then go after how you would spoil that. Because that's, you know, they're not going to start a war if they think it's going to be long and difficult. They'll only start a war if they think we have no credible way of responding.
Well, I was going to hop in with a really pointed question to you, because, you know, you've talked at the tactical level a lot more than we normally do. So the question for, I mean, really everybody in the room is, when you look at Russian military capabilities, what is keeping you up at night?
The air defense network, I would say, without a shadow of hesitation. So first and foremost, all NATO forces, but particularly non-US NATO forces, are cripplingly dependent on close air support and overhead ISR. And almost all of that close air support and overhead ISR, including almost pretty much all of it that is non-US, relies on direct attack munitions. So you have to be overhead in a CAS pattern. And it relies on things like, you know, the Reaper or Predator family of ARPAs and smaller, you know, UAVs, for example, or big wing ISR airliner-derived platforms, all of which are commonly united by the fact that they can't operate in contested airspace in the face of a serious air threat. So, you know, we have developed our force structures on the ground and at sea to an extent with an assumption that there will be on-demand heavy firepower and precise ISR feed for real-time SA. And then we've kind of structured the ground forces and maritime forces lethality and protection along those assumptions. The Russian air defense network means that it will take us weeks, probably months, to actually establish that sort of air access. And by that point, we'll have lost, because their ground-based firepower is so comprehensively outguns what we can put on the field.
And I'd follow on from what Justin said. And the thing that it honestly does actually sometimes keep me awake at night is that it's not an adjunct, but it's part of the integrated air and missile defense as far as the Russians see the world. And we're very good, I think, at actually talking about, you know, oh, how will we get into this air defense network and how will we destroy it and pick it apart? But the other side of the coin is Russia returning fire and making a conflict very painful for NATO. And from what I see from the way the Russians talk about it at the operational and the strategic level, that bar for inflicting pain on NATO is much lower than it is for Russia. And so, you know, they have concepts around long-range precision strikes against military infrastructure within NATO countries. And of course, that raises all sorts of questions around escalation and things like that. But you do have to wonder, you know, how many power stations do you have to conduct a cyber attack against in Germany before the German population says, do you know what, actually, we prefer to have the internet on rather than go to war with Russia? It's a theoretical question, but it's not really discussed very often. And I think it's because it's an uncomfortable conversation about civil resilience more than it is about military resilience. And you have to acknowledge to some extent, you know, if you do hypersonic missiles, obviously, you know, we know an ICBM is hypersonic. But if you're talking about a hypersonic cruise missile, and most militaries would have to hold their hands up and say, yeah, we honestly have no way to stop this once it's launched. And if that is launched, as the Russians say they would consider, against civil infrastructure, then you're opening yourself up to a debate, especially in Europe, about how the militaries are actually quite limited in their ability to stop Russia doing something very aggressive and very heinous that we can't really comprehend. And so I think there's it comes back to the understanding what we're dealing with and how aggressive an opponent might seek to be.
The one thing I'd quickly say, though, as a counterpoint to that, while I absolutely share the concern, particularly if you look at actually logistics and sustainment and maintenance hubs, which are generally not hardened and are well, you know, the locations are known, Russian precision strike capabilities, very, very able to go after those, is that the main Russian concepts around an engagement with NATO would be trying to avoid giving the alliance cause for sufficient political unity to respond in conventional military terms. And therefore, in that initial phase when NATO is scoping out the risk implied by going to war in defense of, say, a territorial breach, I would doubt we would see large-scale Russian strikes outside of the contested area, because that would make it politically much easier for NATO to kind of classify it as an attack on all and you know, start gearing up that full-scale response. So there's definitely a trade-off there in terms of where they would like to have their risk in policy terms.
Well, everybody, we're getting a little bit short on time as always, but the questions and the answers have been just really, really interesting. I'm sure the audience is getting a lot out of this discussion. So I just want to open it up to everyone for parting shots.
Thanks, Lick. I'll jump in quickly. One of them would be on gray zone stuff. I think I would kind of appeal to folks to think perhaps on the perspective that gray zone tools, you know, the use of offensive capabilities in and around the military and security sphere more generally to achieve state goals without going to war. One way of looking at it is if a state like China or Russia is engaging primarily in the gray zone, that is a good thing. That shows that your deterrence is working. Because what we've seen in Ukraine, in Georgia, with these sort of fishing vessels, with the Korean War even back in the day, is that where they don't feel conventionally deterred, they're quite happy and would generally prefer, because it's quicker and plays more to their strengths, to use overt military force. And so, A, keeping opponents in the gray zone is a good thing. It shows that your conventional deterrence is working. And B, if you configure your armed forces and your defense capabilities more broadly, and this is more of a European danger than an American one, but to primarily compete in the gray zone, then there is nothing to stop your opponents saying, well, fine, you're more efficient in the gray zone, but now you can't counter us and match escalation in conventional terms, so we'll just choose to fight in a much more conventional sense. Good luck. So yeah, you know, the gray zone isn't fixed, and it's defined by the defender. It's defined by what your own thresholds are for the use of symmetrical escalation of military capability.
I would really urge people to try and see beyond kind of buzzwords and phrases. I know it helps to conceptually think about certain problems in a certain way, but I think we really do need to focus a lot more on, you know, what would the PLA actually do if it tried to take Taiwan and the US Navy responded in force? What would Russia actually do if it looked to push across the borders in Europe and that kind of thing, and really try and understand that and the way that they talk about it, and put that at the heart of how we respond.
You know, so Slick, it's been a really interesting conversation, especially the way that Justin has sort of worked to reframe gray zone operations. I think from an American perspective, one of the challenges we have with that is that we don't have a interagency or effective interagency response to be able to deal with gray zone operations. So maybe we need to think about conventional responses or conventional deterrence that we would actually be willing to employ in order to be able to halt our adversaries from achieving their political objectives, even when they use gray zone operations. You know, so it's not that we need to go back to low intensity or really radically shift our military force structure and capabilities to be symmetrical, but how do we respond in ways that play to our strengths, even as they're working in gray zone operations, as well as be ready to deter and respond in force with conventional and potentially even nuclear capabilities. You know, the one thing that keeps me up at night is, well, there's a lot of things that keep me up at night, to be honest, when thinking about the complexity of the strategic environment today, but the increased collaboration that we're seeing between China and Russia when it comes to the military. And that's something we didn't talk about today. So maybe we can address that in the future. But right now we're seeing, at least I'm looking at both of those nations beginning to operate more together. They're doing collaborative military exercises. And we've typically viewed Russia and China as maybe, you know, there's a seam, a divide there, a frenemy element that we can exploit. But they might be coming, becoming closer than we've expected in the past. And that's what concerns me.
Yeah, all great points. And I just can't say thanks enough so much for being here. So Justin, really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us on.
And Sam, thanks for joining in. We really appreciate it. And very nice to meet you.
No worries at all. And it's great to meet you all too.
Heather, as always, love having you on the podcast.
Slick, great to be here. See you next time.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in to today's show. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including a few lighthearted flying stories for the holidays, and then some deep dives on space capabilities to kick off the new year. We will also be heading out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we will be next year and also to learn about what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave us a comment to let us know what you think about the show or areas you think we should explore further. And visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to get the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.